Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Today we're looking through a stack of sources that, well, they really reveal something profound about the Kurdish experience, the enduring power of their poetry.
You know, it's striking. For a people navigating centuries, often without a unified state, poetry hasn't just been, let's say, an art form. It feels like it's been much more a lifeline, almost.
Absolutely. A way to record their own history, assert their identity, definitely a voice of resistance, and crucially, a way to keep the language and culture alive when facing, you know, immense pressure.
Right. And these sources we have here, they take us on quite a journey, don't they? From ancient oral storytellers right up to modern voices using the internet to connect globally.
Exactly. So what we want to do in this session is really pull out the key insights, those surprising facts or connections, the aha moments that show why this poetry is so central to Kurdish identity.
You get ready, because the story held within these verses, it's probably richer, maybe more vital than you might initially think.
Let's start at the beginning then. We need to trace this connection way back to ancient roots, even pre-Islam.
And the foundation, like with so many cultures, is this incredibly rich oral tradition.
Mm-hmm. And this is where it gets really interesting. The Dengbej.
Ah, the Dengbej. It's hard to translate, isn't it? More than just singers. They were the living history books, the memory keepers.
That's a great way to put it, living history books. The term itself, Deng, meaning voice, and Bej, meaning to tell. It sums up their role perfectly, giving voice to stories, to history, emotions.
So for centuries, they were the main way communal knowledge got passed down. Epics, local history.
Epics of heroism, love stories, tragedies, local events, even really personal things like lullabies. They preserved it all.
Which becomes absolutely critical when, as you mentioned, writing or publishing in Kurdish was restricted or even banned outright.
Precisely. So this tradition, it almost functioned as a kind of counter-history. It told events from a distinctly Kurdish perspective, subtly, or sometimes not so subtly, challenging the official narratives of the states they lived under.
And sources today are actually analyzing their songs as historical documents in their own right.
Yes, as alternative historical sources. And you can see the perceived power they held, because authorities often tried to suppress them. We see accounts of fines just for speaking Kurdish in public places in Turkey back in the 30s, or outright persecution in later decades, like the 1980s.
But that kind of suppression, it often has the opposite effect, doesn't it?
It really does. It inadvertently politicized the art form. Simply singing in Kurdish, carrying on the Dengbej tradition, became an act of defiance. The music itself turned into a potent symbol of Kurdish identity, of nationalism.
And people found ways around it. I think I read about secret recordings.
Yes, exactly. On cassette tapes, trying to preserve the songs, ensure continuity even under pressure.
It's good to hear there's now more recognition of their value. These Dengbej houses, Mala Dengbej.
Mm-hmm. Efforts to revitalize the tradition, sometimes with support from cultural organizations, even international bodies like the EU, it shows a shift in recognizing their importance.
Okay, so we have this incredibly powerful oral foundation. How does that then transition towards written literature?
Well, that transition really starts gathering pace in the medieval period.
And it wasn't happening in isolation, I assume?
Not at all. It was significantly shaped by the, let's say, the very prestigious literary traditions nearby, Persian and Arabic mainly.
So Kurdish poets were looking at those models.
Yes, they adopted established forms like the qasida, that's a kind of ode, and the ghazal, which is more of a lyric poem, often about love or mysticism. They also adopted the metrical systems, like the quantitative aruti meter, based on syllable weight, imitating those Persian and Arabic structures.
It's fascinating, though, that for centuries, the written output was almost entirely poetry. Prose came much, much later.
Right. Prose really only started developing significantly in the early 20th century.
Why do you think poetry held that top spot for so long?
Several factors seem key based on the sources. First, memorability. In a culture still deeply rooted in oral tradition with lower literacy rates, poetry is just easier to remember and share.
Makes sense.
Second, poetry simply held higher cultural prestige in the wider region's literary sphere at that time. And third, perhaps crucially, it's a form that's incredibly well suited for conveying intense emotions, complex ideas, and deep experiences, especially in potentially restrictive environments.
Okay, so adopting these Persian and Arabic forms wasn't just copying, was it? There was something else going on.
Definitely not just copying. The sources describe it as an act of vernacularization, taking these high-status forms, the structures, the meters, but filling them completely with Kurdish language, Kurdish themes, the Kurdish spirit.
So using the master's tools to build their own house, so to speak.
Kind of, yes. The conscious goal, which you see explicitly with poets like Ahmad Khani, was to elevate Kurdish, to prove it was capable of sophisticated literary expression, that it could stand proudly alongside these dominant languages.
That's a remarkable kind of cultural resilience. And it continued even when formal institutions were shut down, like the madrasas in Turkey.
Exactly. When those religious schools, which were often centers for Kurdish learning, were outlawed in Turkey in 1924, some apparently continued clandestinely. They became these vital underground hubs for preserving the language and its developing literature.
So the long dominance of poetry, it suggests it was seen as maybe the most potent, perhaps even the politically safest, way to express core values. Maybe even early national feelings.
I think that's fair to say. Using condensed language, metaphor, allegory, it allowed for subtle expression, navigating censorship or potentially hostile environments where direct prose might have been more dangerous.
Well, let's take that journey through time then, starting with the classical era, roughly 16th to 18th centuries.
Right. This is when we see foundational figures emerge, writing mainly in the Kurmanji and Guarani dialects, really starting to shape a distinct Kurdish literary language and consciousness.
And the giant figure here is Ahmad Khani.
Absolutely. Ahmad Khani, living around 1650 to 1707. His epic poem, Mem-Uzin, written in Kurmanji, is widely considered the Kurdish national epic.
Famous as a tragic love story, of course. But you're saying the sources point to much more.
Oh, much more. It's a beautiful, heartbreaking story of love, loss, and fate, yes. But Khani weaves into it profound themes of Kurdish identity, a deep yearning for unity, for self-rule.
So he was consciously political, even back then.
Very consciously. He wasn't just telling a story. He was demonstrating the capability of the Kurdish language. His preface is incredibly direct for the time he laments Kurdish disunity, their subjugation by others. It really marks him as an important early proto-nationalist thinker.
A landmark work. Were there other key classical poets, maybe in Kurmanji?
Yes. Figures like Fikir Tehran, from a bit earlier, known for using folklore, his version of Zembil Firoz mysticism, and he gave the first literary account of the Battle of Dimdim, and Malay Sisiri, who founded a distinct school focused more on Sufi mysticism, divine love.
And you mentioned Guarani as well. It had its own classical tradition.
It did. Guarani served as a significant literary language, particularly for the Ardalan Emirate, and it's the liturgical language of the Yarsani faith. Poets like Mele Parishan, Kana Kwabadi, who explicitly expressed pride in writing in Kurdish, and Malawi Taogozi, one of the last great classical Guarani poets.
What's really striking is this flourishing of distinct traditions in different dialects, almost like separate streams.
That's a key insight, what the sources call polycentric development. Because there wasn't a unified state promoting a single standard literary language, you get these different centers of literary activity emerging using their local dialects. The fragmented political reality directly shaped this diverse literary landscape.
Okay, let's move forward. The 19th century, the age of nationalism, is brewing across the region. How does Kurdish poetry respond?
This is really when poetry becomes a primary vehicle for that burgeoning national consciousness. The focus shifts, becomes more explicit themes of resistance, cultural revival, the collective plight of the Kurdish people.
And who's the pivotal figure here, especially for the Sorani dialect?
That would undoubtedly be Nali from Sulaymaniyah. His major contribution was really establishing Sorani as a major literary language. He compiled its first proper diwan, or collection of poems.
So similar to what Khani did for Kurmanji centuries before, Nali does for Sorani right as these nationalist feelings are rising.
Exactly. Perfect timing, in a way. His poetry still touched on love and mysticism, but it increasingly engaged with Kurdish identity, a longing for the homeland, reflecting the political anxieties of that period. The rise of Sorani under Nali gave these emerging nationalist sentiments a powerful written medium.
And was this linked to local politics, too?
Very likely. The sources suggest the promotion of the Sorani dialect by the Baban dynasty, which ruled the area Nali was from, probably fueled its rise as a literary force alongside these growing nationalist ideas.
Were there others building on Nali's work in Sorani during the 19th century?
Oh, yes. Poets like Salim, Kurdi, Haji Kadir Koyi. He is particularly known for quite direct calls for unity, modernization, education for Kurds, and Sheikh Reza Talabani. They all help solidify Sorani's literary status. Their work clearly aimed to unify Kurds, inspire hope, foster that collective identity.
So a definite shift towards more direct political engagement in the poetry itself, addressing the plight of the Kurdish people head on.
Yes, linking cultural revival explicitly with political resistance. It's key development in this period.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rojbash Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. That looks wonderful.
Let's see. Slurp. Nice warmth today. Good spice level.
Maybe.
No, I think it's actually spot on today. Not bitter at all. No need for extra sugar. Just right. Thank you, Hannah.
Much appreciated. Always a welcome pause.
All right, where were we? Right. Tracking Kurdish poetry. We reached the end of the 19th century, now the 20th century. Obviously a period of immense change, massive turmoil, political upheavals, wars, repression, the growth of the diaspora. How did all that hit the poetry?
Profoundly. These incredibly harsh realities shaped both the form and the content of the poetry. While prose finally developed significantly, poetry, well, it arguably remained preeminent, still the most potent voice for many.
And this period sees major innovations, too.
Huge innovations, and new themes emerging directly from these experiences.
Who stands out as a truly revolutionary figure in modern Kurdish poetry?
That would have to be Abdullah Goran. He's widely called the father of modern Kurdish poetry, particularly in the Sorani dialect.
What made him revolutionary?
He made a decisive break from the traditional meters like the Arabic Aruz, which had dominated for so long. He was influenced by European romantics. He even translated Shelley.
So new forms, different language.
Exactly. He introduced freer forms, a more direct, lyrical, almost conversational language. He still celebrated nature and love, themes you see throughout. But he also passionately addressed political oppression, social injustice, really stretching the language's capacity to engage with modern life.
And then there's Shirko Bekis, often called the greatest Kurdish national poet of the 20th century.
That's a title frequently given to him, yes. Another giant of Sorani poetry, Bekis was known for being incredibly bold with form, really experimental.
Like the poster poem I read about. What was that exactly?
Yes. He developed the ruwanj, which means vision or vista, allowing for great imaginative freedom. And the poster poem, these incredibly concise, visually striking micro-poems, almost like slogans, but packed with imagery and emotion.
And these weren't just stylistic tricks.
Not at all. For Bekis, the form was deeply connected to the themes. It was itself a mode of resistance. He talked about preventing inherited culture, including poetic forms, from becoming a kind of prison. He needed new ways to articulate the intensity of Kurdish suffering and aspiration.
His work covered a huge range, didn't it?
Immense. Freedom, nature, often as a metaphor for Kurdistan itself, love, nationalism, the long struggle, exile, but also, unflinchingly, the trauma of events like the Anfal genocide campaign and the Halabja chemical attack. His epic Derbendi Pipu, The Butterfly Valley, about Halabja, is just devastatingly powerful.
That gives modern poetry a function beyond just art, doesn't it? A kind of witnessing.
Absolutely. It takes on this profound ethical memorializing function, documenting suffering, giving voice to victims, demanding recognition, demanding justice. And other modern poets, people like Abdullah Pashu, Kajal Ahmad, they've continued using poetry for resistance, reflecting on exile, and crucially, starting to critique not just external oppressors, but also internal issues within Kurdish society and politics.
Okay, let's step back a bit from the timeline and look across this whole history. What are some of the big recurring themes that keep appearing in Kurdish poetry? Love seems to be everywhere.
It's central and really multifaceted. You have the worldly versus divine love debates in classical works like Memuzin. But then, especially in more modern poetry, you see personal love deeply intertwined with love for the homeland.
How did that work?
Well, poets like Segerswin, for example, might address a beloved woman, but she clearly represents Kurdistan. The personal and the collective fate become fused. Individual feelings mirror the nation's situation.
And nature. The mountains, the landscapes. That imagery feels constant.
Deeply significant. Nature often symbolizes beauty, tranquility, freedom, things often denied. But it's also a powerful spiritual connection to the mountainous homeland. The landscape itself becomes a potent metaphor for Kurdistan, its rugged beauty, its wildness, its resilience, but also its vulnerability.
I think you mentioned Harami poetry being particularly strong on this.
Yes. Sources note its deep integration of environmental reverence, almost an ecological wisdom embedded in the tradition.
And folklore keeps weaving through.
It's a perennial source. Myths, legends, folktales, they keep the poetry rooted in the collective imagination, connecting back to those Dengbe traditions. You see classical poets like Fikiye Tehran using folktales, and even modern novelists like Mehmet Uzun explicitly drawing on the Dengbe's narratives.
Okay, but if you had to pick the defining theme, especially given the history, what would it be?
I think overwhelmingly, it has to be resistance, identity, and the quest for freedom. You know, the idea of the pen as a weapon. It feels very real here.
So poetry is a primary tool against oppression.
Yes, against assimilation, against the denial of identity. One source calls it an active site of resistance and remembrance. Poets actively articulate Kurdish national identity. They retell history from a Kurdish perspective, affirm cultural values, and voice those aspirations for self-determination, for freedom.
It's like they're literally writing the nation into existence in a way.
In a sense, yes. Sherko Bekas is explicitly called a nationalist poet, dedicated to Kurdish values, identity, history, and struggles. And think about it, the Kurdish national anthem, A Rekib, is a poem by Yunus Ruf Dildar. The link couldn't be clearer.
And it documents the struggle itself.
Absolutely. It chronicles the suffering, the brutality, but also the resilience. You see Kajal Ahmad reflecting the brutal context of Ba'athis, Iraq, Bekas capturing the vast range of oppressions.
So its role is to inspire, unify, perhaps mobilize.
That's often the aim. Mm-hmm. And the way it resists evolves, from Kani's more allegorical approach to the overt nationalism of the 19th century, and then in the 20th and 21st centuries, it gets even more complex.
How so?
It continues to confront external oppression, but it also starts to turn inward, critiquing internal Kurdish political issues.
Ah, this is the rift you mentioned earlier. Poets critiquing their own leaders.
Exactly. Sources point this out as a sign of the discourse maturing. Poets who maybe fought for liberation now finding themselves critical of corruption, nepotism, the gap between the ideals they fought for and the realities of governance. Kajal Ahmad's quote is powerful. "The nation we have now is not the nation I worked for." That internal critique becomes vital.
And alongside the thematic resistance, there's a resistance of simply using the language.
Immensely important. When the Kurdic language itself is suppressed, banned in schools or public life, the very act of writing or performing poetry in Kurdish becomes inherently an act of resistance. It doesn't matter what the poem is about, using the language is defiance. This linguistic resistance is fundamental. And tied into all this, of course, is the pervasive theme of exile.
Which makes sense given the history of forced migration, persecution. Many major poets lived outside Kurdistan.
Yes. Bekas, Pashu, many others spent significant periods in exile, and that experience permeates their work.
So lots of yearning for home, nostalgia.
Definitely. The poetry is often filled with that deep longing for the homeland, the pain of separation, the difficulties of diaspora life. Abdullah Pashu creates this vivid personal cartography of exile, writing from cold northern countries full of loss and grief, but also the struggle to stay connected. Bekas constantly expressed that deep longing. The homeland often gets idealized, remembered through intense, beautiful imagery.
But is it just looking back, or does exile offer something else?
It's more complex than just nostalgia. Exile offers a unique, often critical perspective. That safe distance, as one source puts it, allows for a reevaluation of homeland, of identity. It can enable sharper critiques not just of the host countries, but also of internal Kurdish politics.
Right, like Pashu criticizing political parties from afar, or Kajal Ahmad leaving partly due to internal harassment.
Exactly. Exile intensifies the connection to the homeland, but often with a more critical, nuanced understanding. It's not just blind idealization.
And I suppose exile also pushed poets towards international connections.
It absolutely did. It was a catalyst for modernization, for internationalization. Diaspora poets engaged with global literary trends often found more opportunities for publication and translation than might have been possible at home. This helped bring Kurdish poetry onto the world stage, engaging in dialogue with global literature. Bekas's many translations are a key example. Beyond these huge themes of nationhood and exile, contemporary poetry is also tackling broader societal issues, right?
So it's not only about the national struggle anymore.
While that remains crucial, yes, contemporary poets are increasingly engaging in social critique, looking at gender dynamics, current events. Especially in places with some autonomy, like the KRI, poets are scrutinizing the internal landscape.
Like what?
Social injustice, disillusionment with how things are governed, corruption, that collision between revolution and governing that sources mention.
And gender dynamics, you mentioned female poets.
Yes, this is a really significant development. Poets like Kajal Ahmad, Hela Yera, and others are using poetry very consciously to explore women's experiences, to challenge patriarchal norms, advocate for equality, and shed light on, as one source says, the oppressions that occur within a Kurdish woman's life. It's a vital internal critique alongside the national one.
Are they also connecting with more universal themes?
Definitely. Moving beyond purely national concerns to engage with global issues, existential questions, the human condition, global movements like surrealism or philosophical pessimism, poets like Bakhtiar Ali are seen as trying to create a new geography of human relations, making Kurdish stories resonate universally. There's anti-war poetry like Fazil Jalilzada's work aiming to consolidate human friendship.
And that connection to the land, does environmental consciousness appear too?
It certainly echoes those ancient traditions and likely finds expression in modern verse, given how central the home landscape is as a symbol and reality. This wide range shows how contemporary poetry is really dynamic, reflecting and also shaping Kurdish consciousness in very complex ways. Now, something absolutely crucial to grasp is that Kurdish poetry isn't linguistically monolithic. It's not one single language stream. It's a whole tapestry of different dialects.
Which makes sense given the fragmented history and geography we've talked about.
Exactly. Historical and political fragmentation, different state policies towards the language in Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria. It all led to distinct literary traditions developing in Kurmanji, Sorani, Southern Kurdish, Lakaki, Gurani, Azazaki.
Can you give us a quick rundown of the main ones again?
Sure. Kurmanji, spoken by the largest group, mainly in Turkey, Syria, parts of Iraq, Iran, plus the diaspora. It has that rich classical tradition, Kani, Tehran. Now often uses the Latin-based Hawar script, which was itself a modernizing political move. It suffered under suppression, but has seen a strong revival, especially in diaspora.
And Sorani.
Sorani, prominent in Iraqi Kurdistan and Western Iran, rose to literary dominance in the 19th century with Nali, home to giants like Goran Bekas, uses an Arabic-based script. Crucially, it's benefited from having official status and standardization efforts in the KRI.
And Gurani, you mentioned it was older.
Yes, Gurani, often including Harami, represents an older literary layer. It was the language of the Ardalan Emirate, important for the Yarsani faith. It definitely influenced Sorani. Sometimes it's classified separately with Zazaki and Azaza Gurani group.
So if I speak Sorani, can I easily understand a Kurmanji poem?
Generally, no. Without specific learning or exposure, Kurmanji and Sorani aren't really mutually intelligible for most speakers. And the different scripts, Latin versus Arabic-based, create another significant barrier. This linguistic fragmentation inevitably shaped distinct literary paths. And the different dialects themselves have different structures that poets can use.
Ah, so the grammar itself offers different poetic tools.
Exactly. Kurmanji, for instance, has grammatical gender and case endings, ergativity. These offer resources for poetic expression that Sorani lacks. Sorani, on the other hand, has been influenced by Gurani and uses different kinds of syntactic strategies.
So the sound, the rhythm, the possibilities are different.
They are. Gurani verse, for example, often uses simpler structures like rhyming 10-syllable lines, maybe less emphasis on the complex quantitative meters you see elsewhere. These differences create distinct aesthetics. While a shared Kurdish identity unites them, this linguistic reality, coupled with the drive for standardization, often focused on Sorani in the KRI, does raise concerns about marginalizing the unique styles of less dominant dialects. Some experts worry institutions don't pay enough attention to these diverse traditions.
Given all the complexity, dialects, scripts, cultural nuances, translating Kurdish poetry must be incredibly challenging.
Formidable is the word. You've got the sheer linguistic diversity, vocabulary, syntax, even pronunciation differences matter for rhythm, different scripts, lack of full standardization, loan words from neighboring languages, and then the deep cultural context, the figurative language. It's tough.
Can you give an example of that difficulty?
Well, think back to Segerswan's poems where the beloved is Kurdistan. How do you translate metaphors where lions might mean Kurds, foxes mean enemies? How do you convey words layered with both romantic and nationalist meanings simultaneously? Even a simple word for talking might have many regional Kurmanji variants with slightly different feelings. It demands huge skill, linguistic, cultural, dialectal, plus real creativity. Look at someone like Cohen Neer translating Joyce's Ulysses into Kurmanji. Imagine the research, finding archaic words, even coining new ones.
Wow, but for translation is crucial, isn't it? For visibility.
Absolutely vital. For lesser-known dialects, it can be key to revitalization. For the poetry as a whole, it's essential for gaining recognition, whether within the states Kurds live in or internationally. Translations into Persian, for instance, are quite popular in Iran.
Although you mentioned a potential downside in Turkey.
Yes. Some worry that translating into Turkish too readily might decrease the readership for the Kurdish originals, potentially contributing to assimilation in a complex historical context. It's a nuanced issue.
So the act of translating itself often feels like activism.
It often is academic activism or cultural diplomacy. Making this literature accessible counters denial, builds understanding, asserts its value. People undertake this work often with very limited institutional support. And alongside translation, there's the huge task of preservation.
What's being done there? Digitizing things.
Yes, efforts include digitizing old manuscripts, creating online databases. Henar Press is one example. Cultural institutions like the Kurdish Heritage Institute are working to archive oral culture, music, arts. Language academies, like the Kurdish Academy and the KRI, work on development, standardization, dictionaries, trying to balance harmonization with respecting the diversity.
But the KRI leads most of this.
It tends to, given its resources and autonomy, but ensuring all dialects get the attention they need across the board remains a challenge.
It sounds like these linguistic differences, while a source of incredible richness, also create real barriers within the Kurdish literary world itself.
They do. The different scripts, the difficulty translating between, say, Kurmanji and Sorani, it makes a fully unified, easily accessible pan-Kurdish literary canon difficult to achieve in practice. Shared themes unite people, absolutely, but these practical hurdles mean the different dialectal spheres often develop somewhat independently. Looking at where things are now, contemporary Kurdish poetry seems incredibly vibrant, still deeply engaged with reality, but also embracing new influences, new technologies.
So those core themes, resistance, identity, they're still very much alive.
Absolutely. They remain highly relevant, responding to current events, the aftermath of conflicts, the challenges and maybe disappointments of partial autonomy. And that rift, we talked about poets holding their own leadership accountable for corruption, for failing to deliver on promises. That's a key part of the contemporary scene. It's a sign of maturity, where the nation itself is open to critique.
And dealing with past trauma, memory?
Still very prominent. You see it in writers like Bakhtiar Ali focusing on victims. Poetry continues that work of trying to make sense of suffering, preserve memory, articulate paths towards healing or justice.
What about other social issues?
A growing engagement with broader social justice, human rights, including for minority groups within Kurdish society, themes of peace, the costs of war. We mentioned Fazil Jalizada's anti-war poetry. There's also that trend towards more transnational, universal themes, connecting Kurdish experiences to global concerns, reflecting shared anxieties. And influences from global literary movements are still apparent.
And the diaspora is still a major engine.
A vital center for production, preservation, innovation. Remember, places like Sweden provided crucial havens when writing at home was incredibly difficult or dangerous.
And what unique perspectives do diaspora poets bring now?
They grapple with migration, acculturation, multiculturalism, global trends, themes of exile, yes, but also hybrid identities, transgenerational trauma. Nora Hussein explores some of this, that dual consciousness, looking back at the homeland with nostalgia, but also critical distance, while engaging with life in host countries. It definitely leads to new themes, new styles. Plus, the diaspora often has better access to translation, international platforms, helping bring Kurdish voices into global conversations.
And finally, technology, the internet, social media. How has that changed the game?
Profoundly. It's democratized things incredibly. Dissemination, reception, poetry is just so much more accessible now, instantly crossing borders.
Did it lead to new forms like that pop poetry?
Yes. Sources mention things like pop poetry and Bodenin thriving online, shared through chat platforms, video clips, and social media, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube lets poets share work directly, build audiences, connect globally. Noor Hussein credited social media for her reach. It bypasses traditional publishers or journals.
And preservation efforts are using these tools, too.
Absolutely. Online databases, digital archives, they're making centuries of literature potentially accessible in ways unimaginable before.
So digital platforms are creating sort of virtual literary space.
Exactly. A vibrant transnational space, a virtual Kurdistan almost for literary exchange. It helps connect people across regions and dialects despite the linguistic barriers. And themes of exile, identity, globalization really resonate in these online conversations. So when you pull it all together, what does it tell us? This relationship between the Kurdish people and their poetry, it's just this powerful testament to how art can sustain a nation, a people.
Yeah, it's clearly been so much more than just aesthetics. It feels like a vital organ, constantly working for cultural survival, holding on to history, language, fueling resistance, shaping identity through incredibly tough times.
And the way it's adapted. From the Dengbej chanting epics in the mountains to poets sharing verses on Instagram today. It's a story of remarkable resilience, creative endurance, constantly shape-shifting to meet the needs of the moment.
That intensity, that significance, it seems so deeply tied to the unresolved national question, doesn't it?
Intrinsically linked. For a stateless people facing assimilation, repression, poetry has had to carry an immense weight. Preserving memory, championing the language, simply insisting on survival. It's served all these functions way beyond the purely artistic, a tool for unity, a voice for the voiceless, a keeper of wisdom, a badge of defiance.
And looking forward, sounds like it's still evolving, still dynamic.
Very much so. New generations are innovating, drawing on this rich heritage, but also responding to today's complexities. The challenges haven't vanished, of course, but that spirit, that unbroken verse, as some have called it, it endures. It's a living testament to resilience, creativity, and that ongoing quest for freedom and self-expression.
So maybe a final thought to leave listeners with. Here's a question. In our own world, absolutely saturated with information, where do you find the most potent, the most enduring repositories of collective memory, identity, and maybe even resistance?
And perhaps, how might the story of Kurdish poetry make you think differently about what language, what art is truly capable of achieving?